We'll proceed with the last case of the morning, which is In re Craig D. Hansen. And Andre Hansen.
Yes, Your Honor.
You a relative?
Yes, Your Honor, I am. I am Mr. Hansen's brother.
Okay.
And this may be the most fundamental legal point in all of this case, never represent relatives.
Okay. The bookkeeper in the last case was the daughter of the, owner of the company. So. And in the first case, we had a brother and sister that were married. So.
I don't think we have any facts quite that unusual here. Your Honor, if it may please the Court, Andre Hansen on behalf of the appellant, Craig Hansen. Your Honors, Rule 60B struck a balance between the conflicting interests of finality on the one hand and the desire for error-free judgments on the other. And the balance that it struck was that judgments would be that if a judgment contained an error of law, it had to be challenged within 1 year, or that challenge would be forever barred. Now, in this case, the bankruptcy court issued a discharge order back in September of 1997. This discharge order resolved the rights of Mr. Hansen and Great Lakes Higher Education AIDS Corporation with respect to Mr. Hansen's student loan debt. That order contained a mistake of law. It continued to apply a sunset provision that we've been referring to as Section 3008 that had actually been repealed shortly before Mr. Hansen filed his bankruptcy case, but was present in the discharge order. And it's undisputed that the effect of that mistake of law was to discharge Mr. Hansen's student loan debt. Now, of course, the bankruptcy court did grant ECMC's Rule 60B4 motion, and the district court affirmed on other grounds. It's our position that these courts erred in granting that motion. The principal issue before the court is due process. And the standard analysis for due process has always been, was there notice and was there an opportunity to be heard? There has arisen, however, a circuit split on this particular issue, with the Fourth Circuit's Bank case on one hand and the Ninth Circuit's Pardee case on the other, with the Tenth Circuit somehow managing to be on both sides of the circuit split. In the Anderson case that was relied upon by the Pardee case and the later Poland case, which cited Banks. And what the Banks line of cases essentially holds is that because the bankruptcy procedural rules provide a procedure for discharge of student loan debt, any deviation from that procedure is a per se violation of due process. That is wrong for at least three reasons. The first is the statute that permitted the Supreme Court to promulgate the bankruptcy rules. 28 U.S.C., I believe it's 2075, expressly provides that the bankruptcy rules do not enlarge or modify substantive rights. And yet that's exactly what these courts have done with the bankruptcy rules, essentially saying that notice and opportunity is irrelevant because the procedural rules were not strictly followed. Now, this court in the Basile case, which was a habeas case interpreting the rules of criminal procedure, rejected a similar argument. That was a case that was The sentencing guidelines had taken effect shortly before Mr. Basile was convicted of cocaine possession. There was language during the sentencing hearing that he had been responsible for delivering 44 pounds of cocaine. And he disagreed with that, said that statement was taken out of context. The district court never resolved that factual dispute. The district court was required to resolve that factual dispute pursuant to Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 32. This came back to haunt Mr. Basile substantially because under the sentencing guidelines, his eligibility for parole was based on the amount of cocaine he had delivered. He filed his habeas petition claiming that his rights were violated because Criminal Procedure Rule 32 had not been strictly adhered to. This court said, no, that's wrong. You had the opportunity to appeal that. You didn't. Yes, the district court should have obeyed Rule 32, but disobedience of that rule is not part and parcel of a due process violation. Instead, we're going to look at the substance of what happened. Did the court rely on false information? No. That's the only thing we're worried about. The third reason why a per se rule is incorrect is the very recent decision by the Supreme Court in the Tennessee Student Assistance Corporation v. Hood case. And that's something that both ECMC and Mr. Hansen have cited in their briefs, albeit for very different reasons. Hood was not a due process case. Hood involved 11th Amendment sovereign immunity. And the reason the Supreme Court granted cert in that case was to resolve the issue of whether Congress had abrogated 11th Amendment immunity for state agencies that are student loan creditors who have their student loans discharged in bankruptcy. The court didn't reach that issue, and it didn't reach it for two reasons. The first one is, I think, very interesting and pertinent to the case, and that's because the bankruptcy court's jurisdiction is over the REM, not in personam jurisdiction. But the second piece is more critical here. And Justice Thomas had actually dissented on this point. The bankruptcy rules provide that a summons and complaint must be issued in order to initiate an adversary proceeding. The Supreme Court acknowledged that if there's a summons and complaint issued, that implicates the sovereign immunity rights of state agency creditors because they are immune from such service. But the court noted and focused on the fact that this requirement is present solely in the rules. It is not in the code itself. Because the student loan debtor could have proceeded through some other means, such as a motion, the fact that the rules provided for a summons was irrelevant. There is no inconsistency here, I think, between the fact that the student loan creditor or debtor could have proceeded by motion and the state agency's due process rights. The court was not creating a catch-22 situation. Clearly, the court did not require the student loan debtor to do something that would have been prohibited by the due process clause.
Now, with this Chapter 13 that was set up, was it contemplated that was going to be a five-year process, paying what you're able to pay, and then the whole debt would be discharged? Was that the concept?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
It didn't make that clear, apparently. It didn't, I believe I read in there that it didn't, the Chapter 13 didn't actually discharge the whole debt, did it?
I may have misunderstood, Your Honor. The Chapter 13 plan provided for payment of 19%.
About $8,100.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I believe that's correct.
And that would have been theoretically the end of it, had it been legal.
Exactly, Your Honor. And based on the bankruptcy court's discharge order, was the end of it until the Rule 60b-4 motion was granted. Ultimately, Your Honor, the question in this case is whether a violation of law within an order, a legally incorrect order, necessarily deprives a party of due process. We think you must look instead at the substance and quality of the notice that was provided and the opportunity to be heard that was enjoyed. In this case, Great Lakes received substantial notice at every step of the procedure. It had the opportunity to be heard. It took the opportunity to be heard by filing its claim. To the extent that it chose not to either note to the bankruptcy court that these loans were presumptively non-dischargeable, or chose not to appeal this flawed order, does not mean that it was denied the opportunity to be heard.
Were these loans guaranteed by the government?
Yes, they were,
so,
Your Honor.
So they, if they, I don't know how much obligation they have to collect, but they can turn to the government and get paid, what, 80, 90%, something like that?
I don't know the specifics, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thanks. Ms. Whitbank?
May it please the Court, my name is Julie Swedbeck. I'm a senior attorney at Educational Credit Management Corporation in St. Paul, Minnesota. This is not a case about the passage of time or what the debtor might have believed the status of his student loan debt would be when he emerged from his Chapter 13 bankruptcy case. This is simply a case about due process, or what process is due to a student loan creditor in a Chapter 13 bankruptcy before the bankruptcy or the student loan debt can be discharged. And the only question that's before this court is whether the constitutional principles of due process, namely notice and an opportunity to be heard before the debt is discharged, has been met in this case. Both of the lower courts held that the improper form discharge order was entered in by...
That might all be very correct, but it just seems sort of unfair here when... He religiously made his $135 a month payments for 5 years, and now he thinks he's rid of this thing. And 6 years after that, you come in and say, oh, you're not done with us.
Well, what's fair in this case, Judge Evans, is what Congress has provided in the bankruptcy code, and that is that a student loan debt can only be discharged by showing by the debtor through an adversary proceeding that it would be an undue hardship for the debtor to repay the student loan debt. And under the constitutional principles, under the constitutional standard of Mullane, due process is defined as notice and an opportunity for a hearing before the debt is discharged. The debtor has an affirmative obligation, as stated in the Hood's decision, the Supreme Court's Hood decision, to affirmatively seek a discharge of that debt. That was not done here. And so whether it's unfair...
Also, the law also recognizes in a lot of different areas that if you have some rights that you could enforce and you don't enforce them, that you kind of have to live with that.
Well, and that's true, but this is not one of those cases, because in this particular case, contrary to what the debtor would like this court to believe, simply because an order contains a mistake of law, does not limit ECMC or did not limit Great Lakes to moving for relief from that order under Rule 60B1. Not all mistakes render orders void, but where the order is entered in violation of a student loan creditor's due process rights, that order is void and relief is properly granted under 60B4. There is no time limit to moving for relief under 60B4, and that's borne out in this court's decision. In fact, I think it was your case, Judge Evans, in the O'Rourke brothers case, that says that if a judgment is void, it has no bite, there is nothing to appeal from, and it has no binding effect on the student loan creditor's rights to move at any time for relief from that judgment. Now, while this court has not specifically addressed the due process requirements in the student loan context, the Supreme Court and appellate courts in the 2nd, 4th, 6th, 9th, 10th, and 11th circuits have, and have consistently held that to discharge student loan debt, due process requires an adversary proceeding, a summons and complaint, service of process on an appropriate party, and a hearing at which the debtor bears the burden of proving undue hardship. Anything less, as Judge Klein from the Ninth Circuit Bankruptcy Appellate Panel put it, flunks due process. Now, Mr. Hansen asked this court to go it alone and to depart from what is now the prevailing view, and nothing he argues factually or legally compels or justifies his request. Due process is a flexible concept, but every continuum has a minimum threshold. And that, under the Supreme Court Mullane standard, that minimum threshold is the opportunity to be heard. And the cornerstone of this threshold is the fact that the requirement of that the notice and opportunity to be heard precede the deposition precede the deprivation. And that's where Mr. Hansen's case falls apart. Regardless of what he thought, regardless of what his plan said, regardless of what his plan didn't say, there was no notice to ECMC or Great Lakes, and there was no opportunity to be heard before the bankruptcy court, in error, entered a discharge order that contained improper discharge language.
They were getting $135 a month. That must have been some sort of an alert, wasn't it? That's not very much. Take a long time to pay this off. Is there anything in the record that shows that somebody thought that was okay, or maybe did they already turn to the government and say we want to be paid off, which is why this, after all the audit, they find out this is delinquent, and now that's why we're coming back at it. I assume this is recover money for the government, right?
No, yes, that's right. Exactly. Student loan debt is non-dischargeable, presumptively non-dischargeable under the bankruptcy plan. I believe the debtor's payment on the plan, under the plan, is a calculation of what his disposable income is less what his expenses are, and that's how that $135 amount was arrived at. I think it's somewhat naive or unsophisticated to think that you could pay back $135 a month for 5 years and think that somehow magically a $31,000 debt was going to disappear. It doesn't take into account accruing interest. That's interest that's accruing on the debt, which is also non-dischargeable. And whether it was bad advice from his attorney at the time or just a wishful thinking that this is a great way to get rid of his student loan debt, that's not the way the law works, and that's not what Congress has intended in this particular area.
What about Great Lakes, though, as far as notice?
Great Lakes had notice of the plan as any unsecured creditor would have received. It received notice at a post office box address that was stated on the proof of claim. It filed a proof of claim in this matter. Just the federal regulations require student loan guarantee agencies to file a proof of claim in a Chapter 13 solely so that they can share in the distribution from the plan as would any other unsecured creditor.
This was the only debt that he listed, wasn't it?
I think that at the best you can chalk it up to is that it was wishful thinking on Mr. Hansen's part, because there was absolutely no basis in the law. And even if the sunset provision had not been repealed a couple weeks before he filed his bankruptcy, he was under an obligation, as was his attorney, to know what the status of the law was regarding the dischargeability of student loan debt. Now, contrary to Hansen's statement at page 11 of his reply brief, the discharge order was not served on Great Lakes Council. In fact, according to the discharge order's certificate of service, it was mailed to the post office box address that was listed on the proof of claim, and it was addressed to nobody in particular. It is unclear why opposing counsel would make this statement, because he's included correspondence from Great Lakes attorney Lloyd Blaney in his appellate appendix, which plainly shows that Mr. Blaney's address is clearly different from the certificate of service address on the discharge order. Additionally, Judge Shabazz below properly rejected the debtor's attempt to impute notice to Great Lakes through the plan, through the bankruptcy petition, and through receipt of planned payments. What Judge Shabazz said is that there was nothing objectionable in the plan. Great Lakes or ECMC had no reason to question what Mr. Hansen's motives were, because the law provided that student loan debt would survive his Chapter 13 plan payments. Further, the debtor cites no authority to support his argument that the right to appeal or the right to a post-deprivation hearing passes muster under the Mullane standard. And importantly, the debtor doesn't even attempt to refute the authority cited by ECMC that is legally and factually and procedurally on point in this case, namely the recent Fourth Circuit Doan decision, or the Pearson, Tyler, and Amos cases cited in our brief, or the analogous plan language cases such as Banks, Welton, Rule, Rep, or Polin. The best he can do is to distinguish this authority as being the minority view, based on the circuit split that was forming following the Ninth and Tenth Circuit Pardee and Anderson cases. In the last 6 months, however, there's been a seismic shift in the circuits, and the tides have turned on due process grounds. In March 2004, the Ninth Circuit BAP distinguished Pardee on due process grounds in Rep versus ECMC, holding that an order confirming a plan that contains illegal discharge language has no preclusive effect because it offends the notice requirements of due process. And importantly, on September 7, 2004, the Tenth Circuit itself in Poland v. ECMC analyzed the preclusive effect of illegal plan language as well as an improper form discharge order that is exactly like the one in this case and stated, Anderson was wrongly decided and should be reconsidered.
See, that's interesting because if that was in the Seventh Circuit, we would have overruled Anderson. Circulated among all the judges under our Rule 40.
There's another case that's in front of the...
Hanging a footnote in and saying that Anderson case was wrongly decided and should be reconsidered. How do they do that?
It would have been great if they had put it in their majority decision and done that. There's another case that was just recently argued to the Tenth Circuit Bankruptcy Appellate Panel last week. That involves the same issue. And if the Tenth Circuit BAP doesn't affirm that, then it will likely go to the Tenth Circuit, and maybe that will be their chance. See, my time is up, and if the panel has no other questions, I would respectfully ask that this court affirm the district court's decision below granting relief to ECMC under Rule 60b-4.
Okay, thanks. Any time left here? I guess we wrapped up. In case we take under advisement, that completes our arguments for the day. The court will be in recess until, I think, Tuesday.